Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour says the recent shooting deaths of 8 police officers in 2 separate incidents has shocked the nation and left us searching for answers. We, of course, are talking about the shootout with police in Baton Rouge that left 3 officers dead and 3 injured. Gavin Long committed that atrocity. And 10 days earlier, July 7th, Micah Johnson drove to a Black Lives Matter protest in downtown Dallas, determined to kill white police officers, killed 5 policemen and wounded 7 others before he was killed. He goes on to write, "We may never fully know what caused Johnson and Long to commit such horrific crimes. They were both African Americans and served in the military, and that has received significant attention. So what attention should we pay to those facts, that they were African Americans who served in the military?" Our guest has a historical perspective as well. Chad Williams is associate professor and chair of the Department of African and Afro-American Studies at Brandeis University. He specializes in African-American and modern United States history, African-American military history, the World War I era, and African-American intellectual history. He's the author of Torchbearers of Democracy, African-American Soldiers in the World War I Era. We'll be welcoming phone calls and messages as we go along. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our Facebook page, you can give messages there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and our email is talk@wpr.org. And we welcome you to the program. Thank you very much, Professor Williams, for being with us.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
You know, it's good to have you here. We have a lot to discuss. I'm also interested in World War I, which we'll get to during the course of the hour. The fact that both Johnson and Long were African-American military vets, why should we pay attention to the fact that they were veterans? What's the history here that's important to know?
Well, I think it speaks to a certain set of expectations that we have of veterans, that we have of African-American veterans. And I think it also speaks to a more troubled history, quite frankly, having to do with the challenges that African-American veterans in particular have faced in their readjustment to society following their service. Certainly, the fact that they conducted these two really horrific incidents goes beyond just their military service. But I think the fact that they were indeed veterans, the fact that the media has pointed to this as being significant in how we think about these two individuals is worth our attention. And thinking critically about, you know, what was it about their military service, which perhaps could have played some role in why they did what they did.
Mm-hmm. You say in the article that African-American vets have a much higher rate of post-traumatic stress disorder, don't they?
Certainly. You can look at some statistics involving African-American veterans from the Vietnam era. The rates are much higher in relation to white veterans. And I think as we get more and more data related to African-American veterans from some of our more recent and current military conflicts, we're going to see a similar phenomenon. And I think that's really important when we think about both Gavin Long and Micah Johnson. I mean, there's been some new information related to Micah Johnson's experience that he may have had some mental instability while he was in the military. There's another story I saw that Gavin Long may have actually requested VA treatment for a post-traumatic stress disorder. So I think the fact that African-American veterans have had this historical problem with post-traumatic stress disorder and not receiving adequate treatment is very important. But also thinking beyond just the clinical dimensions of PTSD and what it meant historically, what it means contemporarily for African-American veterans to return to a society that is not altogether welcoming of their presence, having to still confront racism, discrimination, lack of economic opportunities. I think that type of trauma is also very significant and could perhaps exacerbate the experience of black veterans.
When you write in the piece that Johnson described as demented, a disgrace filled with hatred, initial reports suspect that Long suffered from paranoia and mental instability. Wouldn't all of those signs have been present when they entered the military, and then perhaps a military experience exacerbated it? Does it beg the question, are we screening carefully enough for people going into the military who may have serious mental problems that should be dealt with in the States?
Certainly, yeah. I think that's an excellent question, and that really cuts across race. I mean, we could think about that for all soldiers, male and female, across the board. It does speak to the particular challenges that I think the military has faced in trying to recruit an all-volunteer force.
Yes.
The draft was done away with post-Vietnam, 1973, the military institutes an all-volunteer force. How a lot of the recruitment that the military, all branches, focuses on is in poor working class communities, how the military has obviously afforded very important economic as well as educational opportunities. But you are recruiting from a demographic that faces a whole host of challenges that need to be thought of in, I think, a very holistic way. And factoring in race into that equation, I think, is also very important. What are the particular challenges that working class African-American men and women have to endure on an everyday basis in civilian life, and then what are they bringing with them into the military?
Mm-hmm. Give us a little background here. You talk about for most of history, the military has been deeply racist institution, black soldiers having to endure often virulent discrimination and abuse.
Right, right. Well, African Americans have a very long and very proud history of service in the United States military. Going back to the American Revolution, African Americans have served in every military conflict in this country's history, have performed heroically in numerous occasions, have been true patriots in every sense of the term. And it's also important to acknowledge that the military has afforded African Americans significant opportunities as well. But with that being said, the military is a part of American society. And just as America, in its long history, has been deeply racist, discriminatory against African Americans, the military has reflected that as well. You know, it wasn't until 1948 that the military began the process of desegregation. You know, prior to that, African Americans were forced to serve in segregated units where they were deemed inferior. Oftentimes, were not given the opportunity to serve on the battlefield, were relegated to service units. Oftentimes, had to endure racial hostility that was both physically as well as psychologically abusive from their white superiors. So that type of historical baggage, if you will, is something that the military is still, I would argue, continuing to grapple with.
Mm-hmm.
They have, I think, made a concerted effort to try and address that history, to try and make sure that the military is a truly egalitarian institution. But I'm sure you can talk to many African-American veterans today, and they will tell you that there is still racism within the military. It may not be as institutionalized as it was in the past, but those type of sentiments and attitudes, just as they exist in American society at large also exist within the military.
You've written in your extensive work on World War I about the idealism, the reasons for going to war that may have resonated particularly deeply with African Americans. You discuss Woodrow Wilson's declaration of war against Germany, the world must be made safe for democracy, framing the war as a crusade to secure the rights of democracy and self-determination on a global scale. The words you write immediately resonated with many African Americans who viewed the war as an opportunity to bring about true democracy in the United States. It would be insincere for the U.S. to fight for democracy in Europe while African Americans remained second-class citizens. A couple questions. I want you to talk more about that. And has that also been a guiding light and peculiar more to African Americans than to other people, that kind of idealistic reason for bringing a true form of democracy to other places?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, thank you for mentioning my work on World War One, which I think is really a critical turning point, obviously, in world history, in the history of the United States more specifically, but also in the history of African Americans in the military, where you have the mass mobilization of an American army, which includes African Americans. Some 380,000 African Americans served in World War One, and they were deeply inspired, for the most part, by this crusade to make the world safe for democracy. Those ideals of democracy resonated very deeply with African Americans, and they approached World War One as an opportunity not just to make the world safe for democracy, but also to make the United States safe for democracy for African Americans. They fought very hard on and off the battlefield to make that a reality. Many of their hopes and aspirations were met with great frustration. And I think that speaks to a longer history of disillusionment with the stated ideals and principles that the United States oftentimes fights for. You know, we can also look at a similar dynamic in the aftermath of World War II, right? Another war fought for freedom and democracy. And when African American veterans come back to their homes, especially in the American South, they're treated as second-class citizens, oftentimes less than human. So the dissonance between fighting for your country, risking your life for your country, for these very powerful ideals of freedom, democracy, liberty, which the United States holds so dear, and then not being able to reap the benefits of that once you take off the uniform, I think is incredibly powerful.
Thus, some former soldiers, you remind us, played pretty big roles in the civil rights and black power movements of the 1960s.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. So I think we see in the case of those individuals how they, on the one hand, are kind of radicalized, if you will, as a result of their experience, how the Army, or excuse me, the military more broadly, has kind of functioned as a form of racial and political consciousness raising for many African American servicemen and women. And then they look for opportunities after the war to try and make sense of those experiences, but also to translate what they experienced into sustainable forms of activism. Right, so you see African American veterans joining the NAACP in significant numbers, joining groups like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and also more radical groups such as the Black Panthers,
right,
and other groups. So I think in that respect, so we, you know, take this back to Michael Johnson and Gavin Long. I mean, how they are clearly searching for some type of way to express their racial consciousness and frustrations, not able to do that by joining or effectively engaging in any type of organization or structure to channel that frustration, I think lends to a theory that they found a much more destructive way to, mm-hmm. to express themselves.
And really with Drew, Johnson's mother talked about how her son became a hermit when he came home.
Yeah, yeah. So there's this, you know, really quite tragic sense of isolation that I think we see in both of their experiences. And again, not to minimize the totality of the tragedy of what took place both in Dallas and Baton Rouge, but you know, what did we miss? You know, in the case of these two individuals, why weren't they able to return to civilian life and be a part of something? Why were they so isolated? Why were they left to themselves? And why was there not any type of larger structure or community to make sure that they were taken care of?
Mm-hmm. And how affected were they? If you're already a pretty troubled person, when you see police shootings in St. Paul and in Baton Rouge, how does that fit into both narratives?
I think it's a really interesting question that, in some respects, goes beyond just the issue of African-American veterans. How are these constant images and videos of black people being killed, being shot by the police, affecting the psyches of African-Americans? Right? What type of trauma does that do? And you know, what are the implications mm-hmm. of that? So in the case of Michael Johnson and Gavin Long, two individuals who may have already been suffering from some type of psychological disorder, that very well could have served as some type of triggering effect to push them over the edge. Again, that dissonance between their service, fighting for their country, and then seeing black people, you know, being shot by representatives of the American state. You know, that very powerful disconnect between you know, what they saw as their sacrifice to their country and that not being reciprocated could very well have been, you know, the spark that set them off.
Chad Williams talking about the troubled history of black veterans in America. Chad is associate professor and chair of the Department of African and Afro-American Studies at Brandeis University. His special areas are African-American and modern U.S. history, military history, African-Americans and the World War I era, and African-American intellectual history. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we would love to have your messages sent there because we'd like to read them when we're on the air or off the air. That's The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we'll be taking your phone calls in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Todd in Appleton, hi.
Hello. Good afternoon, Professor Williams. I'm a veteran of the Army. I retired from the Army in 1991 as a master sergeant. And I came back in after a five-year stint during the 60s. I came back in and joined the military police, and this is after the all-volunteer Army was put into effect. And I have to say that the military police is quite a rainbow organization as far as my commanding officer was a lady from West Point, and most of our senior NCOs were white and black, about 50% for each. But, and talking to the Afro-American NCOs, not sergeant majors and below, most of them chose to stay in the Army for the reasons that you were outlining is because they couldn't see possibilities back where they were coming from, even though a lot of them got their college degrees while in the service. A lot of them had, a lot of us went to the same kind of training and everything else, and we were dealing with the public a little bit more than the rest of the Army was, being military police. And they just didn't feel that they would get a fair, they told me right out, they just didn't feel they'd get a fair shake going back to wherever they were from in the South or in some of the bigger cities. And I just did notice that all the way up to when I retired in 1991. And they felt safer, they were able to raise families in the military and have a good career plus a pension. But I just thought I'd bring that fact up also. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the call.
Yeah, well, I think that's an excellent observation that, especially after the advent of the all-volunteer force, African Americans have enlisted in all branches of the military at higher rates than their percentage in the larger population, for some of the very reasons that the caller mentioned: educational opportunities, the lack of economic opportunities in civilian life, the fact that the military afforded a way out, and the possibility for a career, for career advancement. So there certainly is a very powerful story to be told there about the military as a socioeconomic ladder for African Americans. With that being said, I think there's also numerous incidents where soldiers fall through the cracks, where they do their tour of duty, and they return to civilian life and really struggle to readjust, to reap the benefits that they feel that they're owed. So part of the challenge, I think, in understanding the history of African Americans in the military and black veterans is how do we balance the narrative of success that African Americans have had in serving in the military with a dual narrative of kind of disillusionment and disappointment.
Thank you, Todd, for your call. Gary in Glendale, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you very much for the story and giving me a chance to tell a local influence on the army, segregated army during the Second World War. I have stories of my own during the integrated army, but my dad was a major called to active duty, and a small businessman from O'Connell Falls, a son of Swedish immigrants, who in his third major assignment commanded a basic training battalion at Fort Lewis, Washington, that was 100% black, except for the officers and some of the NCOs. And he was really proud of them. He said they behaved better than the battalions that he commanded at Camp Edwards, Massachusetts earlier. And I'm just sitting here waiting to come off online. I kind of recall him saying that he had to discipline some of the white officers from the South from the way they treated the guys. Hmm. But yeah, but just think of the cultural experience of this small-town Wisconsin guy coming up, having 800-plus black kids from all over the country, you know, who are going to go on to combat duty from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So. Yeah, I think, I mean, you have stories like that throughout the totality of the history of African Americans in the military, of African Americans demonstrating their humanity, demonstrating their discipline, proving all of the stereotypes of African Americans to be just that, to be false, and how the military has also served as a way for racial barriers to begin to be broken down, even if it's just one soldier, one white officer at a time. So I think it's in that regard not a coincidence that we see the birth of the modern civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s happening after World War II, where obviously you have a lot of African American veterans who are determined to fight for civil rights, but you also have a lot of white veterans who are sympathetic to African Americans' claims for increased civil rights and citizenship.
Thank you so much for your call, Gary. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I found it interesting that both of these African-American vets, Johnson and Long, one was in the U.S. Army Reserves for 6 years. That's a pretty long time. Completed a tour of duty in Afghanistan, and Long, a former Marine, served for 5 years. That's a long time to be in the military.
Yeah, again, I think there's the opportunities that the military afforded. We see African Americans, I mean, really going back to the Korean War, Vietnam era, repeatedly enlisting, having the highest rates of reenlistment, even during the Vietnam War, where you might think that African Americans, based on how they were disproportionately represented on the front lines, experienced higher casualty rates, would not want to reenlist. But the incentives were such that they outweighed, you know, the cost of returning back to civilian life and not having anything to show for it. So in that regard, it's, you know, perhaps not that surprising that they served for as long as they did.
Mm-hmm. Is it difficult, do you think, because of the horrendous nature of the actions committed by these guys in Baton Rouge and in Dallas? You asked the question whether or not we should mourn for them, for Micah Johnson and for Gavin Long. Did their lives matter? A lot of people would say, heck no, we shouldn't mourn for them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's a very difficult question to ask. I mean, certainly we mourn for the loss of the police officers in both Dallas and Baton Rouge. But I think, you know, if we want to place this in the context of our current national conversation, if you will, about race, and just what we mean when we say Black Lives Matters, right? Are we really talking about all Black lives? You know, what about those individuals who don't fit our norms of respectability? What about those individuals who commit crimes which are so awful that we see them as somehow, you know, less than human? I think I would like for us to grapple with that question and what it means for us as a nation to try and think about all people, you know, who are citizens of this country, especially those who have sacrificed, you know, in putting on the uniform of the United States military, and thinking about you know, how we can perhaps understand them and respect their lives as well.
Lance is our next caller in Winter. Hi, Lance.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
All right, Lance. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Good.
The reason I called is, from what I understand, the guy in Dallas, they found a bunch of gun stuff. He did. He had this all planned long before the two shootings. And I understand that his mom said that he was depressed. Why didn't she try to get help for him?
I don't know the backstory on that. I was amazed by the number of weapons this guy had. He was doing all these drills out in his backyard. To me, I would have wondered what the heck's going on here.
Yeah. Well, I think there's certainly going to be an ongoing investigation about what possibly motivated him. You know, why wasn't his family more involved in his day-to-day life? So I think those are all facts that hopefully will come out at some point. But I think you do raise a larger point about our larger kind of civic and familial responsibilities, you know, for caring for veterans, and how we need to take seriously the types of challenges that they confront on a day-to-day basis, and not just look idly by when we see veterans struggling and putting themselves in positions of isolation. So hopopefully we can all take that responsibility more seriously, if there's any lesson to be learned from this.
Well, and there are so many, Professor Williams, veterans who are struggling. They're really struggling. There are so many homeless veterans, and access to mental health care. It's a perennial problem after almost every war, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Actually, President Obama is in Atlanta today addressing the National Convention of Disabled American Veterans, you know, trying to, again, make the case that we need to devote more attention to our veterans, and you know, certainly the type of care and treatment that they have received has not been adequate. I mean, there's certainly more than enough room to critique the performance of the Veterans Administration in terms of responding to disability claims. We have confronted this problem kind of throughout the long history of American military service. But I think it is particularly acute at this moment when there's challenges just in terms of how our government goes about its daily business, and especially allocating the necessary funds for veterans. Our current debate now with Donald Trump and disparaging the families, the family of a soldier who was killed in Iraq, the Khan family. This is, I think, a larger conversation we need to have about how do we talk about, how do we care for veterans in very serious ways.
Right. Well, we keep saying we need to do it. You know, how many times do we have to keep saying this? We've been saying this for years.
Right.
Yeah. Remind me, and I'm wondering if there is any historical comparison, if we can learn anything from what happened in 1973 and what happened in 2016. In your article, you write about Mark Essex. I'd forgotten about this case, who murdered nine people, including five police officers in New Orleans in 1973. How did we respond to that then?
This was a case that I think many people either don't know about or have forgotten about. Mark Essex was a veteran, a Navy veteran, who left the Army, left the Navy, very disillusioned, disgruntled with the racism that he experienced. He became involved in a number of different what we might call black radical organizations, ultimately killed nine people, including five police officers in New Orleans in a bloody shootout. I think that's obviously a very extreme case, but does kind of echo some of the facts and circumstances surrounding both Micah Johnson and Gavin Long's incidents. In terms of how the larger public responded to the Mark Essex incident, I'm not quite sure. Mm-hmm. But again, that was such a turbulent time in our country's history. In some ways, I'm sure it was kind of seen as symptomatic of the larger kind of racial and political challenges that the country was struggling with.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you write about, and I want to hear more about this, the historical fears of radicalized black soldiers and vets sparking racial conflict, especially in the South, and killing white people dating back to Reconstruction era, continuing after World War I and World War II. And I'll bet there was some of that, looking at the Black Lives Matter and the number of people who had, because, of course, it was Texas, where they're doing this weird thing today of letting people carry guns to classrooms 50 years after the massacre on that campus. Figure where that comes from. But I'm sure there were people who looked at that, African-Americans who had guns in the Black Lives Matter protest, and all of a sudden it was, ooh, are you going to spark racial conflict here? There are echoes of the past right here and now, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And like you mentioned, you can really take this back to the post-Civil War period, where you have African-American Union soldiers who are stationed in the South following the end of the war, who are serving as an occupying force, and the type of hatred that sparked amongst former Confederates, the image of black men in uniform, armed, ordering white people around. That was visceral, and that continued throughout the late 19th century, when you have Buffalo soldiers who are oftentimes stationed in the American South, especially in Texas. Texas seems to be a particular flashpoint for racial violence involving black soldiers and white police officers and civilians. Certainly in the aftermath of World War I as well, this fear that African-American soldiers who were trained in firearms would return to the South. Again, these aspirations for democracy swelling in their heads and would carry out some type of plan for retribution. A lot of these fears and anxieties were just that, were anxieties. But you do have several incidents where black soldiers are engaging in violent altercations and sometimes fatal shootings with white Southerners and police officers.
We welcome more phone calls. We're talking this hour of the show with Professor Chad Williams. He's a professor and chair of the Department of African and Afro-American Studies at Brandeis University, specializing in African-American and modern U.S. history. He specializes in the World War I era, is the author of Torchbearers of Democracy, African-American Soldiers in the World War I Era. He wrote a very interesting piece that caught our attention, and it's about the African-American shooters in Baton Rouge and also in Dallas, and says that we must pay attention, and he pays a lot of attention in many different areas, to the military service of both of these killers. And that's what we're talking about this hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Chad Williams of the African and Afro-American Studies at Brandeis University is our guest this hour, and we're talking about the very troubled history of black veterans in America and focusing on the black vets who committed the horrors in Baton Rouge and also in Dallas. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Does it behoove us, Professor Williams, to learn as much as we can about Johnson and Long? And do we know very much at this point about either one of them?
I think there is some information that is coming to surface. I know the military released some information regarding Johnson's time in the Army Reserves. I think we do need to be careful not to jump to conclusions until we find out as much information about them as possible, so we can at least try to understand what their motives may have been, what type of influences they may or may not have had. So obviously, as a historian, I want to make sure that I have all the facts and information as part of the challenge of writing about current events. Mm-hmm. But I think, with that being said, it's important to place what they did in a type of historical context. So while we might not be able to understand kind of the specifics about their lives at this point, at least we can try and situate them in a larger historical narrative to kind of make sense of what actually took place.
Mm-hmm. And going back to World War One, for the Baltimore Afro-American asserted, you write about this, let's have a real democracy for the U.S. and we can advise a house cleaning over, and then we can advise a house cleaning over on the other side of the water. The Baltimore Afro-American asserted, for African-Americans, you write, the war became a crucial test of America's commitment to the ideal of democracy and the rights of citizenship for all people, regardless of race. So did we pass the test?
I think we are still trying to pass that test. I make the point in my book that democracy is a work in progress, that the ideals of democracy, the everyday aspects of American citizenship are still being fought for to this day. This is, I think, what our current historical moment teaches us, is that the challenges of grappling with the history and legacy of race in the United States in relation to the ideals and aspirations of American democracy are very fraught. And I think it behooves us to understand that this is an ongoing struggle. Right? I mean, really, since the founding of the nation, trying to reconcile the ideals of the nation with its legacies of race and racism. So we are very much still fighting that battle.
Mm-hmm. Well, and here it is front and center again in the Republican presidential campaign. Whatever you think of Donald Trump, and some people may, you know, really like him, the fact that he came to such prominence in addition to reality TV by insisting that the president was born in Kenya is just, there's a huge element of race in that, isn't there?
Absolutely. I think that we cannot divorce the phenomenon of Donald Trump from the phenomenon of Barack Obama, that the kind of unprecedented nature of the first African-American president has given rise to the unprecedented ascendancy of someone like Donald Trump, who has, you know, really rooted so much of his campaign on appealing to disaffected, disgruntled white voters who feel that in some way the country as they knew it has been taken away from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think President Obama is a very powerful symbol of that, which has sparked a lot of the fears and anxieties which Donald Trump has taken advantage of.
Mm. I thought the president, I was watching him and realizing how important what he said was and how masterfully he handled the deaths of the African-American young people unarmed in Louisiana and St. Paul and the deaths of the police officers. This idea of really caring about all of those incidents, he just said it in such a masterful way, I think. And only he probably could have done that, you know?
It was certainly a very difficult balancing act.
Yes.
I think he did a very impressive job of making the point that we can protest police violence against African Americans, mm-hmm, and the injustices in our criminal justice system and still support police officers. Right? And I think this is also the point that many in the Black Lives Matter movement are making as well, right? That the fight is not against police officers per se. Right? It's against a system that has criminalized blackness, right, and has given rise to the type of conditions in which African American, both men and women, are more prone to fatal encounters with police. Right? So it's about, you know, trying to wrestle with the conditions which have given rise to the type of really, you know, tragic incidents which we've become all too familiar with over the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 800-486-8655. Bob is next in Coon Valley. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to, a lot of times, you know, we see things through racial lenses, and I wondered if that might be a factor at all here. You know, the veterans that committed the two shootings that we're talking about were black, but are there white veterans who do the same thing that we maybe just don't hear about because they're white? I mean, certainly the Dallas event was unprecedented, but are white veterans doing similar things and we just don't hear about them?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. I know the military, I'm forgetting the exact year, released a report which warned against homegrown terrorists coming out of the military, essentially disgruntled veterans joining extremist groups and perpetuating homegrown domestic violence. I think there is something to be said for looking at this problem, if you will, across racial lines, how you know, we are not taking, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder seriously. You know, we're not taking the type of easy access to firearms that many of these individuals have, the type of, you know, radicalization across the ideological spectrum that they may be subjected to or engaged in after they return from the military. So I would agree with you that, you know, this does cut across, you know, racial lines in some regards. But I think, you know, we also have to take race seriously as well, right? The fact that both Micah Johnson and Gavin Long were veterans, but were also black. We're also African-American. And they made it very clear in their actions and also the type of affiliations they were cultivating, that they saw themselves, you know, through a very clear racialized prism. We have to grapple with that as well, and not just kind of dismiss race as a factor in how we grapple with what happened.
Anything else, Bob?
Nope, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. The Southern Poverty Law Center does a lot of work on extremist groups, violent groups, usually racist groups. Are there many, if any, extremist groups, African-American extremist groups advocating violence?
You may have some. Again, I think these are very fringe groups. The New Black Panther Party, for example, I know has been labeled as a hate group promoting racial violence. So there may be some of that, but you know, Gavin Long made a point to emphasize that he was acting on his own, that he didn't have any affiliations whatsoever. That you know, Micah Johnson, again, he seems to have been acting alone as well. So I wouldn't put too much credence into claims that they were, you know, radicalized or in some way affiliated with, you know, so-called black radical groups. I think in this case, you know, while they may have been searching out some type of organization or groups to be affiliated with, I think it's you know, looking like it was more a case of their isolation and frustration and instability, which may have triggered these tragic incidents.
Mm-hmm. And because you have the historical perspective, Professor Williams, on all of this, would you say, and it's kind of a blanket statement I'm asking here, but I'm wondering specifically how things may have become better and how things may have become worse when you look at the span of, go back to the Revolutionary War or World War One. You're an expert on World War One to today. Are things more equitable for African-American servicemen? Are things better, or are there persistent aspects of racism that need to be addressed now? And if so, what are they?
Right. Well, one of my my favorite writers and thinkers is W.B. Du Bois, the famous civil rights activist and scholar. And he writes about the meaning of progress and just how do we measure progress. And I think that's a really important question to ask right now, you know, how we think about race relations outside of the military and also inside of the military. I think there's no question that race relations are better than they were a generation ago, two generations ago, that the military has improved in very significant ways as far as how it deals with race and opportunities that African Americans have to rise through the ranks. So yes, I mean, we can point to very real progress and, you know, say, I think with a fair amount of definitiveness that things have gotten better. But that doesn't mean you discount all the things that are still going wrong,
mm-hmm.
right? I think you can acknowledge progress, but also, you know, make the point that there is still a lot of work that needs to be done, right? And to dismiss that is in some ways a type of violence in and of itself, right? Because it doesn't recognize, you know, the hurt, the suffering that perhaps a Gavin Long or Micah Johnson might be grappling with. Part of, I think, the challenge we have in thinking about the experiences of African Americans in the military, thinking about the history of race in the United States today, is being open and honest and trying to reckon with our past in honest ways.
Mm. Thank you ever so much for being with us. It was really an interesting hour. Thanks, Professor Williams.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Chad Williams, Associate Professor, Chair of the Department of African and Afro-American Studies at Brandeis University. He is author of Torchbearers of Democracy, African-American Soldiers in the World War I Era. Tomorrow, during this hour, we're going to be talking about it feels like we're constantly being bombarded by disturbing content on the news. What is all this doing to us? That's the second hour. First hour, spending on prisons grown three times as much as spending on public education. So we'll look at that issue. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing this hour. And thanks to Carrie Salinas for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for listening.